29. Take small bites. The fait accompli strategy. If you seem too ambitious, you stir up resentment in other people. Overt power grabs and sharp rises to the top are dangerous, creating envy, distrust, and suspicion. Often the best solution is to take small bites, swallow little territories, playing upon people's relatively short attention spans. Stay under the radar and they won't see your moves, and if they do, it may already be too late. The territory is yours, a fait accompli. You can always claim you acted out of self-defense. Before people realize it, you have accumulated an empire. Piecemeal conquest. On June 17, 1940, Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of England, received a surprise visit from the French General Charles de Gaulle. The Germans had begun their blitzkrieg invasion of the Low Countries and France a mere 5 weeks earlier, and they had advanced so far, so fast, that not only France's military, but its government as well, had already collapsed. The French authorities had fled, either to parts of France not yet occupied by the Germans, or to French colonies in North Africa. None, however, had fled to England. But here was General de Gaulle, a solitary exile seeking refuge and offering his services to the Allied cause. The two men had met before, when de Gaulle had briefly served as France's Undersecretary of State for War during the weeks of the Blitzkrieg. Churchill had admired his courage and resolution at that difficult moment. But de Gaulle was a strange fellow. At the age of 50, he had a somewhat undistinguished military record and could hardly be considered an important political figure. But he always acted as if he were at the center of things. And here he was now, presenting himself as the man who could help rescue France, although many other Frenchmen could be considered more suitable for the role. Nevertheless, de Gaulle might be someone whom Churchill could mold and use for his purposes. Within hours of de Gaulle's arrival in England, the French military sued for peace with the Germans. Under the agreement the two nations worked out, the unoccupied parts of France were to be ruled by a French government, friendly to the invaders and based in Vichy. That same evening, de Gaulle presented Churchill with a plan. Broadcasting on BBC radio, he would address all Frenchmen still loyal to a free France and would urge them to not lose heart. He would also call on any who had managed to get to England to contact him. Churchill was reluctant. He did not want to offend the new French government with which he might have to deal. But de Gaulle promised to say nothing that could be read as treachery to the Vichy government, and at the last minute, he was given permission. De Gaulle delivered the speech much as he had outlined it, except that he ended it with the promise he would be back on the air the next day. This was news to Churchill. Yet once the promise had been made, it might look bad to keep de Gaulle off the air, and anything that would hearten the French during these dark days seemed worthwhile. In the next broadcast, de Gaulle was decidedly bolder. "Any Frenchman who still has weapons," he announced, "has the absolute duty to continue the resistance." He even went so far as to instruct his fellow generals still in France to disobey the enemy. "Those who rally to him in England," he said, "would form part of a nation without territory to be called Free France, and of a new army to be called Fighting France, the spearhead of an eventual liberation of mainland France from the Germans." Occupied with other matters and believing de Gaulle's audience to be small, Churchill overlooked the general's indiscretions and allowed him to continue his broadcasts, only to find that each new program made it harder to pull the plug. De Gaulle was transforming himself into a celebrity. The performance of the French military and government during the Blitzkrieg had been widely seen as a disgrace, and in the aftermath, no one had stepped forward to alter this perception of cowardice, except de Gaulle. His voice radiated confidence, and his face and tall figure stood out in photographs and newsreels. Most important, his appeals had effect. His Fighting France grew from a few hundred soldiers in July 1940 to several thousand a month later. Soon, de Gaulle was clamoring to lead the forces on a campaign to liberate French colonies in Central and Equatorial Africa from the Vichy government. The area was mostly desert and rainforest and was far from the more strategic regions of North Africa on the Mediterranean, but it contained some seaports that might be useful, and so Churchill gave de Gaulle his backing. The French forces were able to take Chad, Cameroon, the French Congo, and Gabon with relative ease. When de Gaulle returned to England late in 1940, he now had thousands of square miles of territory under his control. His command, meanwhile, had swelled to close to 20,000 soldiers, and his bold venture had captured the imagination of the British public. No longer the low-order general who had sought refuge months before, he was now a military and political leader. And de Gaulle was equal to this change in status. He was now making demands of the English and acting in a rather aggressive manner. Churchill was beginning to regret giving him so much leeway. The following year, British intelligence discovered that de Gaulle had been making important contacts among the growing French resistance movement. The resistance, which was dominated by communists and socialists, had started off chaotic, lacking a coherent structure. De Gaulle had personally chosen an official in the pre-war socialist government, Jean Moulin, who had come to England in October 1941, to help unify this underground force. Of all de Gaulle's maneuverings, this was the one that could benefit the Allies most directly. An efficient resistance would be invaluable. So, with Churchill's blessing, Moulin was parachuted into southern France in early 1942.